If they allocate it only according to effectiveness in the growth process, it ends up going to those with less need. Together with David Dollar, my colleague at the World Bank, I came up with the idea that aid should be allocated so as to lift as many people out of poverty as possible. We tried to see how, in practice, need and effectiveness could be reconciled. In deference to the technocratic mindset, we termed our idea poverty efficiency, which must rank with human capital as a linguistic carbuncle. Anyway, the actual allocation of aid was very far from being poverty efficient. The biggest deviation was that far too much aid was going to middle-income countries rather than to the bottom billion. The middle-income countries get aid because they are of much more commercial and political interest than the tiny markets and powerlessness of the bottom billion. Not all agencies are equally guilty. If we take the two biggest, the World Bank is far better protected from political influence than the European Commission, and so its aid has been much better targeted to the poorest countries. But herein lies a paradox. The World Bank, until very recently, has only been able to provide loans, whereas aid from the European Commission is entirely in the form of grants. So the loans have been going to the poorest countries, and the grants to the middle-income countries. You might reasonably think that this is not particularly sensible, and that aid allocation could be greatly improved. But if aid were better targeted to the bottom billion, would it help break the traps? Aid and the conflict trap. Can aid actually make things worse? Some researchers think so. Aid may be an inducement to rebellion and to coups, because capturing the state becomes more valuable. In the societies of the bottom billion, aid is probably the key part of what is sometimes called the rent to sovereignty, the payoff to power. So is big aid an incentive to rebellion or to coups? How do you tell? Conduct a survey of rebels and coup leaders? Unker and I followed the same general method for both rebellions and coups. Look at all of them and try to allow for the fact that aid is allocated purposively, so less tends to go to countries with the highest risks. Then, allowing for this purposive allocation, bring aid into the analysis of the causes of rebellion and the causes of coups. Of course, with this approach, you cannot tell whether aid has had an effect in any particular instance, but you can tell whether it has a significant effect overall. On average, as far as we can tell, aid has no direct effect on the risk of civil war, though it has indirect effects, which I will come to shortly. This does not mean that it never has direct effects. People expert in particular situations can give you stories on each side, of aid inciting war or averting it. Any of these may well be right, but they do not add up to a systematic relationship. With coups, it is a different matter. Big aid indeed makes a coup more likely. So, going back to some of the results of Chapter 2, rebellions are encouraged by natural resource wealth, but not by aid, and coups are encouraged by aid. Why this difference? Perhaps because a rebellion usually takes many years. The prospect of aid if the state is eventually captured is not a potent lure. Resource rents, by contrast, are useful to rebels in the here and now of the conflict, because they can be grabbed along the way. You don't need to control the entire state to control a diamond mine in the middle of nowhere. And why is aid a lure to coups if it isn't to rebellions? Perhaps because a coup does not take many years before it is resolved. It is over virtually as soon as it has begun, and if it is successful, the aid is there for the taking. So to an extent, aid does make the conflict trap worse, but it can also make things better. Recall that the key risk factors in rebellions and coups are slow growth and low income. The indirect effects of aid on conflict risk are benign. By raising growth, and thereby cumulatively raising income, aid reduces these risks. Is the payoff worth the costs? Unker and I tried to answer that question. We already had an estimate of the costs of the typical civil war, around $64 billion, and we had just estimated how aid would reduce the risk of war through raising growth. So by putting the two together, we got an estimate of the payoff to aid from enhanced security. To our surprise, it turned out that the payoff was not big enough to justify the cost. The reason was that aid was not very effective at raising growth in the conditions of poor governance and policies that typified the bottom billion. Challenged by Jeff Sachs, who thought we had asked the right question but come up with the wrong answer, we experimented. In countries with better governance and policies, that is, the countries that had already broken free of the poor governance trap, the security benefits started to mount up, reaching perhaps half of the cost of the aid. And of course, our cost of conflict did not include any adverse spillovers for rich countries, such as drugs and terrorism. So although security considerations alone probably do not justify a big aid program, in some countries they are a substantial addition to the normal benefits of aid, higher income and increased domestic consumption. However, the cost-benefit analysis of aid for security looks very different in post-conflict situations. In these situations, the security benefits alone are more than enough to justify a large aid program. Recall that these are the times of highest risk. Around half of all civil wars are post-conflict situations gone wrong. Aid happens to be particularly effective in raising the growth rate in these situations. That is hardly surprising. This is how aid got started. The World Bank was originally called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and in fact, the "and development" bit was literally an add-on. Aid was invented to rebuild Europe after the Second World War. It worked. In more recent times, the mistake with aid to post-conflict situations has been that it has been too little and too soon. Yes, too soon. The peace settlements hit the media and the politicians hit their checkbooks. Aid floods in during the first couple of years, then rapidly dries up. Yet the typical post-conflict country starts with truly terrible governance, institutions, and policies. It takes some time to improve them to a level at which aid can be of much use. So big aid needs to be sustained during the first decade post-conflict, not just the first couple of years. To their credit, the donors are learning. Post-conflict interventions really got going only after the end of the Cold War. Until then, everything was too polarized. So the stock of experience has been pretty limited. For example, the World Bank introduced post-conflict considerations into its criteria for aid allocation only around 2000. In the years of the Cold War, its reconstruction role had been forgotten. And even when it introduced its special post-conflict allocation, the extra money for a country was designed to be phased out after the first 3 years. In 2005, the rules were changed so that the extra money now lasts for 7 years, a much more reasonable time frame. Agencies are learning, and aid so used has an important role to play in breaking the conflict trap. But aid alone is not enough. Growth is a slow process, and it takes time to bring risks down. After a decade of rapid growth, post-conflict risks are usually brought down to manageable levels. But during that first decade, even big aid cannot do much to bring the risks down. We have to look at other ways of containing risks during that period while aid does its slow work of rebuilding the economy. Other than in the post-conflict period, to the extent that aid raises growth, it is also useful in bringing down the risk of conflict. But the problem is designing aid in such a way that it works even in the environments of poor governance and poor policy that are most at risk of conflict. I will come to that. Let's first look at how aid affects the other traps. Aid and the natural resource trap. The second trap was the natural resource trap. Here, frankly, aid is fairly impotent. Evidently, the resource-rich countries have money coming into the government. They do not use it very well. There is nevertheless a moment for aid in these environments. That moment is when they try to reform, an incipient turnaround. I will return to it in the discussion of the trap of poor governance and policy. Aid and the trap of being landlocked. The third trap was being landlocked. These are the countries that basically need to be on international welfare for a long time. Eventually, they might become viable, depending upon when their more fortunate neighbors start to grow and what market niches turn up. But we should not pretend that there are easy answers. In the meantime, there is no fast track available for these countries. In retrospect, it was perhaps a mistake for the international system to permit economically unviable areas to become independent countries. But the deed is done, and we have to live with the consequences. One of the consequences is the need for big aid as a means of raising domestic consumption in these desperately poor environments, even if the aid does not do much for growth. For these countries, the psychology of aid needs to recognize that it is not there as a temporary stimulus to development, it is there to bring some minimal decency to standards of living. Probably the key role for development aid, as opposed to direct support for consumption, in the landlocked countries, is to improve their transport links to the coasts. Recall that the costs of transport to the coast vary enormously and tend to reflect the transport infrastructure of neighbors. Aid should have been financing the regional transport corridors that are the lifelines for the landlocked. It has largely failed to do so. Why? One reason was that in the 1990s, infrastructure went out of fashion, at least for aid agencies. This was partly because there was an exaggerated belief that the private sector would finance infrastructure, so the aid agencies had better find something else to justify their continued existence. For example, in the World Bank, an agency whose core business had been infrastructure was now lumped in with private sector development and finance, the whole package being merely one of five networks. The shift away from infrastructure was also because there was growing pressure to spend aid on the photogenic social priorities, health and education, and on the increasingly sacred environmental goals, both of which got networks all to themselves at the World Bank. So agencies shifted their budgets away from infrastructure to make room for increased spending on the new priorities. The other reason why regional transport corridors got neglected was that aid programs were overwhelmingly organized country by country. Uganda's links to the coast depended upon transport infrastructure in Kenya, not in Uganda. But the Kenyan government did not care about Uganda, and with the growing emphasis upon country ownership of aid programs, if the government of Kenya did not care, then neither did those donors who gave money to Kenya. So the underfunding of infrastructure and country-driven aid programs together did in the regional transport corridors that the landlocked needed. Aid and the trap of bad governance. The fourth trap was being stuck with very poor governance and policies. Can aid help in getting countries out of these problems? This is where I think there is the most scope for additional aid. There are three ways in which aid can potentially help turnarounds: incentives, skills, and reinforcement. Let us see what works. Aid as an incentive. The use of aid as an incentive for policy improvement was initiated in the 1980s. It was known as policy conditionality. The donors provided aid if the government promised to reform. It was a pretty hopeless failure. There were two basic problems with it: the psychology and the economics. The psychological reaction to being told to do something is resistance. Any parent knows that, and it is just as true of governments as it is of children. How else can they establish their freedom? So conditionality pushed governments, and indeed whole societies, into opposing policy changes that would have been highly beneficial. Policy conditionality also messed up accountability. If governments were being ordered about by donor agencies, whom should an electorate blame if things went wrong? Governments were quick to exploit the full potential for evading responsibility. In the week when the government of Zimbabwe launched economic reforms in 1998, its Minister of Information told the local press, "They're not our reforms, they're the IMF's. We had to do them." That sort of statement not only shifted the responsibility, but made the reforms very easy to reverse, and the government of Zimbabwe most surely reversed them. Policy conditionality, as then practiced, depended upon the government promising to make changes. This, for those of you who prefer to think in Latin, is known as ex ante conditionality. The economics of getting money on the basis of a promise is known as the time consistency problem. Unless incentives are properly aligned, governments will promise, take the money, and then do what they like. To give you a real-life example, the government of Kenya promised the same reform to the World Bank in return for aid five times over a 15-year period. Yes, five times it took the money and either did nothing or made token reforms that it then reversed. The amazing thing is that the money kept coming. How did Kenyan government officials manage to keep straight, sincere faces as for the fifth time, they made the same commitment. How did officials of the agency manage to delude themselves into thinking that adherence this time was likely? But aid agencies have very little incentive to enforce conditions. People get promoted by disbursing money, not by withholding it. Eventually, the World Bank and other donor agencies realized this limitation and largely switched to disbursing aid on the basis of the attained level of policies rather than on promises of improvement. For the Latin speakers, this is ex post conditionality. It was more consistent with the research evidence that suggested that whether aid worked well depended upon the level of policies rather than on how they were changing, and it avoided the need for promises. The only problem was that it squeezed aid out of the very countries that have the biggest problems. On the most favorable interpretation, it was a realistic recognition of the limits of aid to help in these environments. On a less favorable interpretation, it was giving up on the very environments where the agencies were most needed. Anyway, forget ex ante policy conditionality as a way of inducing policy improvement in failing states. It just doesn't work. I take a very different view of governance conditionality. The key objective of governance conditionality is not to shift power from governments to donors, but to shift power from governance to their own citizens. The struggle for this transfer of power took around 200 years in Europe, and we should indeed want to speed it up in the bottom billion. External pressure was vital in the European struggle. The most common account of that struggle goes as follows. The threat of war forced governments to defend themselves with big armies. To pay for these armies, the governments needed to tax. To get compliance for high taxation, they had to concede representation and scrutiny. We cannot go through that process in the bottom billion. In Europe, the threat of war turned into a reality sufficiently often for the whole process to have been murderous, and it would probably be so again. It was also slow. But the purely internal processes by which citizens force governments to accept scrutiny are probably pretty weak. External pressure is needed, and it is entirely legitimate. Why should we give aid to governments that are not willing to let their citizens see how they spend it? Governance conditionality, in its ex post form, is gaining in popularity. Most dramatically, U.S. President George W. Bush launched his new Millennium Challenge account based largely on allocation criteria of attained levels of governance. He wisely chose not to allocate the additional American aid money through the established American Aid Agency. For over the years, U.S. aid has been captured by congressional commercial lobbies. Voting line by line on U.S. aid's budget, Congress has diverted spending so as to benefit particular American exporters, unrelated to African needs. However, somewhat surprisingly, no agency is doing ex ante governance conditionality. One advantage of such an approach is that it would be much clearer what a government had to do and on what timescale in order to be rewarded by extra aid. And the aid could be targeted to countries that initially had weak governance. So it would focus on the bottom billion instead of excluding them. I will spell out more fully what I think could be the practical content of governance conditionality in Part 5. We have to accept that there are severe limits to what aid can do to improve governance, but we are not yet at those limits. Aid as skills. Conditionality looms large in discussions of aid because it is so sensitive. But reform of governance and policies is not just a matter of political will and political pressure. It also requires people with the relevant skills. Typically, in the societies of the bottom billion, the civil service has lost whatever skills it once possessed. Once over dinner, the former head of the civil service in one of the big bottom billion societies described what had happened to the civil service that he had helped to build. He asked me to imagine being a schoolboy in his country on the eve of independence. The bright boys in the class aspired to join the civil service to help build the country. At the other end of the class, what were the aspirations for the dumb class bully? Forget the civil service with its tough exam. So the class bully set his sights on the army. Fast forward 2 decades and a coup d'etat. The army was now running the government. Between the class bullies, now the generals, and their objective of looting the public sector, stood the class stars now running the civil service. The generals didn't like it. Gradually, they replaced the clever boys with people more like themselves. And as they promoted the dumb and corrupt over the bright and the honest, the good chose to leave. Economists have a term for it: selection by intrinsic motivation. So by the time the military ceded power back to civilian politicians, the civil service was broken. Far from being the vehicle for developing the country, it was a vehicle for looting it. Politics is full of idiosyncrasies, and from time to time, reform-minded ministers and presidents come to power. But it is very difficult for them to implement change because they inherit a civil service that is an obstacle rather than an instrument. It is hostile to change because individual civil servants profit from the tangled mess of regulations and expenditures over which they preside. Aid has a potential role of providing the skills that the civil service lacks when they are most needed. Recall from Chapter 5 that together with Lisa Chauvet, I looked at the preconditions for a turnaround from a failing state and for the conditions that helped success once a turnaround had started. In fact, the main purpose of our work was to see whether aid was helpful, either as a precondition or once a turnaround had started. We decided to distinguish between two types of aid: technical assistance and money to governments. Technical assistance means the supply of skilled people paid for by the donor. Although the donor spends money, what the recipient government gets are skilled foreigners to work for it. Technical assistance accounts for about a quarter of all the money spent on aid. The other three quarters is money either handed to governments to finance specific projects, such as a school, or simply provided to the government without a specified use, which is called budget support. Even to distinguish between technical assistance and money to governments was difficult, because the donor agencies just have not been bothered to record their activities properly. We relied upon data provided by the Paris-based Development Assistance Committee of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, the main donor club. Even they thought the data were of poor quality. I'm going to focus on technical assistance. Usually, the fact that a quarter of aid is provided as technical assistance is presented as some sort of scandal, on the grounds that the countries do not see any money. All they get is people. But really, it depends upon whether the people are of any use. Reforms need skills, and in the bottom billion, these skills are lacking. Remember, the skilled people have already left. They're in London, New York, and Paris, not Bangui. The politically correct answer to the need for technical assistance is to support capacity building instead. That means train the locals rather than fly in experts. There is a lot of sense in capacity building, but there is also a chicken and egg problem. Until the country has turned itself around, capacity building is pretty difficult. You train people to an international standard, and if there are no prospects, then they use their credentials as a passport out of the country. I know. I have been training people for 3 decades. In the early stages of reform, not only do the reformers need skills that are unavailable in the country, but some of these skills will no longer be needed once the transition has been accomplished. It actually makes sense for a country to import a bunch of skills temporarily while it gets over the hump of reform. So Lisa and I introduced technical assistance into our analysis of turnarounds. Did it help as a precondition for a turnaround? Did it help once a turnaround had already gotten started? Did it help when a new leader had just come to power? As usual with aid, we faced the problem that causality can run in both directions. The better the prospects of a turnaround, the more technical assistance the donors might choose to supply. To the extent that donors get this right, aid will tend to be targeted to situations that are ripe for improvement, and hence subsequently do improve. With such behavior, it is indeed likely that aid will appear to raise the chances of a turnaround. But this would be because the wrong version of causality has been forced on the relationship. We might equally have found that a good prospect of reform causes aid to go up. The way to overcome the problem is to find a component of technical assistance that can be predicted country by country, year by year, and is devoid of any influence from the country's governance and policies. Fortunately, a substantial component of a country's aid receipts are determined not by its own current circumstances, but by the characteristics of donors. For example, Ethiopia is likely to get a relatively large amount of aid from Italy, since Italians see their brief invasion of Ethiopia as giving them a historical connection, and Côte d'Ivoire is likely to get a relatively substantial amount of aid from France, its former colonial master. Abidjan used to be known as Africa's Paris. So if the Italian aid budget goes up and the French aid budget goes down, Ethiopia is likely to get an increase in its aid receipts relative to Côte d'Ivoire. Since this component of aid is unrelated to policy conditions in the recipient countries, we can study its effects on the chances of a turnaround and be fairly sure that causality is running only from aid to the turnaround. To continue the example, from time to time, Ethiopia or Côte d'Ivoire gets lucky or unlucky with a configuration of aid donors, and we can see whether luck or the lack of it has any effect on the chances of turnaround. Unfortunately, as far as we can tell, technical assistance in a failing state prior to turnaround has little effect on the prospect of a turnaround occurring. The experts come and preach and people listen politely, but not much happens. This is bad news for the agencies that do this and little else, and it is also bad news for failing states, since pouring in big technical assistance would be pretty easy. However, things look dramatically different once a turnaround has started, or indeed if the state has a new leader. Technical assistance during the first 4 years of an incipient reform, and especially during the first 2 years, has a big favorable effect on the chances that the momentum of the reforms will be maintained. It also substantially reduces the chance that the reforms will collapse altogether. To me, this makes sense, because these early periods of turnaround are when the courage of a few brave politicians meets the brick wall of obduracy and incompetence in the civil service. Beyond the few reforms that just require the minister to sign something, stroke of the pen reforms, most reform needs technocrats and managers able to implement change. Lisa and I were quite surprised that the effect of technical assistance came out so strongly, and so we decided to push our luck. Could we tease out any sense of how much technical assistance was useful during this early phase of reform? Again, to our surprise, we found that we got an answer in which we could have some statistical confidence. It told us that technical assistance packages during reform could usefully be really big. Typically, up to around $250 million a year could be spent on providing technical expertise before additional money became useless. We first compared this with actual technical assistance during reform episodes. The actual scale of assistance was typically far lower, so donors appeared to be missing an opportunity. But at this stage, we had not compared the costs with the benefits. If the benefits were sufficiently modest, then donors would be right in passing up these apparent opportunities. To discover whether pouring in technical assistance during incipient reforms is worth the money, we needed to determine whether the benefits exceed the costs. It was simple enough because we already had our estimate of the costs of a failing state, around $100 billion, which I described in Chapter 5, and we now had the amount by which a technical assistance package would raise the chances of sustaining an incipient turnaround. We just had to bring the two together. The payoff came out at around $15 billion, and the cost of maximal technical assistance sustained for 4 years is only around $1 billion. So donors were in fact missing a really good opportunity for aid. Spend $1 for an expected return of $15. And don't forget that the only benefits counted in that $100 billion are to the neighborhood. The additional security that spills over to the wider world is a bonus. So why are aid agencies missing this opportunity? After all, it is not as if technical assistance overall were negligible. Money spent on providing countries with the skilled people who constitute technical assistance is a quarter of total aid flows, so it is huge. The problem is not the overall insufficiency of technical assistance, but rather that it is organized so as to be unresponsive to country circumstances. In the parlance of the agencies, technical assistance is supply-driven rather than demand-driven. The same assistance is poured into the same places year after year without much regard to political opportunities. Indeed, given the prevalence of ex-post policy conditionality, putting the money where things are already satisfactory, agencies simply cannot put their resources into failing states early in a possible turnaround. It is against the rules. technical assistance needs to be reorganized to look more like emergency relief and less like a pipeline of projects. Just as when the Southeast Asian tsunami struck in December 2004, emergency relief teams were quickly flown in, so when political opportunities arise, skills should be available. Ideally, reforming ministers need to be able to draw on a large technical assistance account, which is theirs to decide how to use. And this would be useful even in the resource-rich failing states. Although the governments of resource-rich countries have revenues that, in principle, could be used to pay for big technical assistance, they are unlikely to do so. The political cost of using revenues in that way at the start of a reform effort would be massive. And so, at the right time and for the right things, aid can be very productive, even in breaking the natural resource trap. Aid as reinforcement. So aid as technical assistance can help turn around failing states. What about aid as money provided to the government intended for projects or budget support? We followed the same approach and got completely different results. Money early in reform is actually counterproductive. It makes it less likely that the reform will maintain momentum. I was pretty suspicious of this result until we found a completely separate result that looks remarkably similar. I briefly mentioned it in Chapter 5, but now I want to make more of it. This is the effect of terms of trade windfalls, such as oil booms and coffee booms. You might imagine that an improvement in the terms of trade would make reform easier. After all, there is more money coming into the country and people are better off. It turns out to be the opposite, however. A terms of trade windfall early in a reform has the same adverse effect as an aid boom, in that early money chills the prospect of sustaining the reform. There is no technical economic reason for this, so it must be political. I wanted to get some insight as to whether the politics was really like this, so I asked Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who at the time was Finance Minister of Nigeria, and not just any finance minister either. She was named Finance Minister of the Year for 2005 by The Banker in recognition of her efforts at reform. I first encountered her in the mid-1990s when she wrote to me at Oxford out of the blue. I was running a research center on African economies, and she was a director at the World Bank. She wrote asking whether she could come to the center for a month, using her vacation from the World Bank to study. Not many World Bank directors have done that. Anyway, by 2005, she was the ideal politician for this question. There she was, implementing reform, and doing it with remarkable success, in the midst of a huge oil boom. I asked her whether the high oil price that was generating big revenues for the Nigerian government was making reform easier or harder. She laughed. Harder, much harder, was her assessment. Why? Because people's attention was focused on getting the extra oil money that they knew was there, rather than on the often painful, tedious, and fractious business of reform. Why lay off people when there is oil money? Why delay projects by insisting that the contracts be put out for competitive bid when there is money to pay in excess of the competitive price? And perhaps that is an example of a more general pattern. Sudden extra money, whether from export booms or aid, detracts from the hard choices involved in reform. After reform has continued for a few years, the statistical effects of technical assistance and money reverse themselves. Technical assistance becomes useless or even counterproductive because, I suppose, governments at some stage need to build their own capacity rather than continuing to rely upon outside experts, and money starts to become useful, reinforcing the reform process instead of undermining it. So what seems to show up is a sequence. Aid is not very effective in inducing a turnaround in a failing state. You have to wait for a political opportunity. When it arises, pour in the technical assistance as quickly as possible to help implement reform. Then, after a few years, start pouring in the money for the government to spend. Aid used in this way to support incipient turnarounds would be pretty high risk. Even with aid, many incipient turnarounds would fail. The payoff is high because the successes, when they happen, are enormously valuable. The process of aiding turnarounds is thus analogous, in terms of risk-taking, to a venture capital fund. Most of the firms in which a venture capital fund invests fail, but the fund overall can be successful because of a few winners. For aid agencies to become truly focused on the bottom billion, they will need to adapt to this high-risk mode of operation. The venture capital fund approach is, I think, the right managerial model for dealing with such risks, because it reconciles accountability with incentives. A venture aid fund preserves accountability for overall performance, but managers can achieve overall success despite a lot of failures. Without this sort of model, bureaucracies just cannot cope with risk. Their staff will not take large risks because they imply periodic failure, and failure means a blighted career. Unsurprisingly, people are simply not prepared to take risks on these terms. The situation is getting worse as people are increasingly assessed in terms of the results they achieve. Within aid agencies, there is a vogue for a results orientation, and up to a point this is sensible. Senior managers are trying to get their workforce to focus on outcomes, not inputs. But a focus on results can very easily encourage people to avoid failures at all costs. And if this happens, aid will increasingly be directed to the safe option of countries where performance is already satisfactory. To its credit, the British government has understood this problem and provided the World Bank with the money to launch a fund that can be used to support turnarounds. Will other governments put money into this fund? To my mind, that is one of the critical steps for aid in the next couple of years. If you want your children to grow up in a world with fewer failing states, one of the practical things you can do about it is to urge your government to back this sort of aid finance. Aid prior to reform. The effectiveness of money pre-turnaround depends upon how it is given. The traditional way of trying to ensure that aid is spent properly is through projects. Instead of just giving unencumbered money to the government, the agency agrees on a project with the government and helps to design and implement it. This is a cumbersome approach that is inappropriate for countries with reasonable governance, but for the countries with very weak governance, it is probably sensible. There is, however, a catch. Projects done in countries with weak governance and poor policies are known to be much more likely to fail. Recently, Lisa and I were asked to investigate whether there was anything that could be done to make projects implemented in failing states more successful. The donors had liked our work on turnarounds enough to agree to finance a second phase. We used a huge data set that reported evaluations of thousands of donor projects around the world. It took us a long time to make sense of it, and I will issue a caveat. The results I'm going to describe are not yet published, and so have not yet been subject to peer scrutiny. Sure enough, we found that in failing states, projects were much less likely to succeed. But our question was whether anything could be done about it. Anything, that is, that was within the donor's ability to control. It could, for example, be the type of project, or it could be how the project was implemented. It turned out that money spent by the agencies on project supervision had been differentially effective in failing states. It is this differential effectiveness that is the key result. If you put together the much lower success rate of projects in failing states with the differential effectiveness of supervision, then there is a clear implication for how an aid agency should function. Supervision costs money. It comes from the administrative budgets of aid agencies. So an implication is that when agencies operate in failing states, they should budget for a considerably higher ratio of administrative costs to money actually disbursed. Of course, agencies are under pressure to reduce their administrative costs relative to the money they disburse. This is sometimes used as a measure of agency efficiency, but it is misplaced. The environments in which agencies should increasingly be operating are those in which, to be effective, they will need to spend more on administration, not less. Mismeasurement of bureaucratic performance is a general problem. In aid agencies, it encourages low-risk, low-administration operations that are the precise opposite of what they will need to be doing to meet the coming development challenges. There is one other approach I would like to see tried in failing states, and that is what is known as independent service authorities. The idea is that in countries where basic public services such as primary education and health clinics are utterly failing, the government, civil society, and donors combined could try to build an alternative system for spending public money. The key features would be a high degree of scrutiny by civil society as to how the money was being spent, competing channels of service delivery encompassing public, private and NGO, and continuous evaluation to see which was working best. The authority would be a wholesale organization for purchasing basic services, buying some from local governments, some from NGOs such as churches, and some from private firms. It would finance not just the building of schools and clinics, but also their day-to-day operation. Once such an organization was put into place, managed jointly by government, donors, and civil society, both donors and the government would channel money through it. As it demonstrated that it was spending money well, donors would increase the flow of money. If performance deteriorated, the donor money would dry up. Not all governments of failing states would be willing to go along with such a model, but some would. It has not been tried yet, but let me give you an example that briefly got halfway there. The Chad-Cameroon oil pipeline has become a cause célèbre because the NGOs, quite rightly, worried that oil money going to the government of Chad would not be well spent. Indeed, it was more likely to deepen problems than resolve them. The attempted solution was the creation of a system of civil society scrutiny, known as the Collège de Contrôle et de Surveillance des Ressources Pétrolières. The oil money flowed into an account controlled by the Collège, which had to approve all expenditures. The expenditures were restricted by law to social priorities such as health and education. The evidence that this system was basically effective is that within months of it coming into operation, in January 2005, the government of Chad changed it. Unsurprisingly, it wanted to make security a priority, read money for the military. The Collège was evidently effectively restraining the government from spending the oil money on the military. Otherwise, why go through the embarrassment and penalties involved in changing the law? Thus, we can think of the Collège for the Chad-Cameroon pipeline as a proto-independent service authority. Paradoxically, although the idea has been tried only for oil revenue, it is much better suited for aid. The reason harks back to the time consistency problem that we have already encountered in other contexts. The Chad deal was unfortunately not time consistent. The deal was that the government of Chad would pass a law establishing the Collège, and in return, the oil companies would sink $4.2 billion of investment into oil extraction. Now ask yourself which of these is easier to reverse, the law or the investment. Once you have answered that, you have understood the time consistency problem and can see why it would not be such a problem if instead of oil, it was aid. With aid, you do not have to sink $4.2 billion in order to get started. It is just a flow of money that can be switched off, unlike the flow of oil. Knowing this, the government has no incentive to tear up the deal. What is the downside of an independent service authority? Well, it is that you start afresh rather than trying to reform the government ministries step by step from within the system, and so it is appropriate only when things are really bad and unlikely to get better by incremental means. So, to be clear, I do not want these authorities everywhere in the bottom billion. I want them to be an option in the worst settings, where the realistic prospect is that otherwise we are going to wait a long time for significant change. I call them independent service authorities for a reason. Many governments have already established agencies called independent revenue authorities, whose function is to raise tax revenue. The function was taken out of the traditional civil service for precisely the reason that I want basic public services to be taken out of the traditional civil service. There was no realistic prospect of the traditional system being made to work. Why did governments go for the radical option on revenue, but not on service delivery? The answer is depressingly obvious. Governments benefit from the revenue, whereas ordinary people benefit from basic services. Governments were not prepared to let the traditional civil service continue to sabotage tax revenues, because governments themselves were the victims. They were prepared to leave basic service delivery unreformed because the government elite got its services elsewhere. Aid and marginalization. In Chapter 6, I argued that globalization was actually making things harder for the bottom billion. Export diversification has become more difficult because of China and India. Capital flight has become easier because of global financial integration. Emigration has become more attractive as the rich-poor gap has widened, and more feasible as diasporas from the bottom billion have become established in the West. Hence, even countries that escaped from the traps might find themselves in limbo, unable to replicate the success of poor countries 20 years ago. How does aid affect this marginalization? The major concern about aid is that it exacerbates the problem of breaking into global markets for new exports. This is due to Dutch disease, which I discussed back in Chapter 3. Aid, like natural resource revenues, tends to make other exports uncompetitive. The IMF feels so strongly about this that its current chief economist, Raghuram Rajan, a smart academic on leave from the University of Chicago's Business School, launched a blistering public critique of aid in June 2005, just ahead of the G8 summit. It became a front-page headline in the Financial Times. His research showed that aid tended to retard the growth of labor-intensive export activities, precisely the activities needed for diversification in the bottom billion. So there is indeed a problem, and it has to be faced rather than denied. Fortunately, quite a lot can be done about it. For a start, the aid can be spent on helping the export sector, for example, improving infrastructure at the ports. Even if such aid causes Dutch disease while it is being spent, once the port is improved and the aid is scaled back, there is no further Dutch disease, just a better port. What is required is a once-and-for-all big push, country by country. Such aid would be targeted at lowering the costs that potential exporters would face. It does not make sense to attempt such an approach everywhere. The landlocked and the resource-rich are likely to be out of the game, and there is little point in spending aid to try to get them into it. And even among the coastal, resource-scarce countries, those with really bad governance and policies may be out of it, although the experience of Bangladesh, previously described, suggests that poor governance is not necessarily a killer for exporting. The bottom billion would look a lot more hopeful if a few of their coastal economies really started to take off in global markets. Pioneering success is a sensible use of aid money, partly because of the demonstration effect of role models. And remember, unless the coastal countries do well, the landlocked have few options. A big aid push for exporting is a risky venture, because until it is tried, there is simply no way of knowing whether it would work. In my view, it is well worth the risk. But like other risky uses of aid, it simply will not happen under present incentives for aid agencies. Concentrating aid for a few years in a few countries and spending it on a strategy for export growth just breaks too many of the rules. Not only the rules of caution that I have already discussed, but also the rules of fair shares. Agencies operate with two types of fair shares rules. One is for countries. It is difficult to privilege one country over another, even temporarily. Although if the Krugman-Venables thesis of agglomeration economies is right, then one of its implications is that such temporary concentrations of aid are likely to be efficient. The other type of fair shares rule may be even more difficult to surmount. Fair shares among internal agency interests. Every aid agency is divided into fiefdoms: rural development, education, health, and so forth. Trying to get an aid agency to focus its resources on an export growth strategy runs afoul of all these interests. For if there is more money to be spent on the country, you can be absolutely sure that the rural development group will lobby for its share of the spending, whether that is important for export growth or not, and the same is true of the education group, the health group, and all the others. In bureaucracies, spending means jobs, promotions, success. It is how, in practice, staff measure themselves. So the present aid system is designed for incrementalism, a bit more budget here, a bit more budget there, and not for structural change. Yet we know that incrementalism is doomed because of diminishing returns to aid. Just doing more of the same is likely to yield a pretty modest payoff. For aid to promote structural change in countries requires structural change in aid agencies. What else can be done to offset Dutch disease? Well, the aid can be spent on activities that have a large import content. Aid automatically increases the supply of imports, but depending on what you use it for, it can also increase the demand for imports. That is one advantage of technical assistance. It is all directly spent on the import of skills and so does not cause any Dutch disease. Aid spent on infrastructure will have a much higher import content than aid spent on education and so will cause less Dutch disease dollar for dollar. Finally, the adverse effects of aid can to an extent be offset by changes in trade policy, but I will come to that in Chapter 10. Is aid part of the problem or part of the solution? One of the bugbears of the political right is that aid is going into Swiss bank accounts. Sometimes it does. There are well-documented cases. But what is the general relationship? Is aid financing capital flight, as it is financing military spending? Again, in the end, it is an empirical question, not something that you can deduce from the first principles of an ideology. It's easy to think of ways in which aid might leak out into capital flight. For example, the president just steals it. But there are also ways in which aid could reduce capital flight. It is true that for this, you have to think a little bit harder, as the image of the president stuffing dollars into his briefcase comes more easily. But here is an alternative mechanism. Aid improves the opportunities for private investment, and so money that otherwise would have fled the country gets invested inside it. That is evidently quite possible. The question is, which predominates empirically? For this project, I teamed up again with Anke and Kathy. We had all worked on capital flight together twice before, and by now we knew how to control for two-way causation in interpreting the effects of aid. I should note that at this stage, we have had our work reviewed by anonymous referees for a professional journal, and the comments have been sufficiently encouraging for us to continue the process of revision, but it has not yet been published. Our results indicate that aid significantly reduced capital flight. This surprised us, probably because that powerful image of the president stuffing his briefcase had penetrated our minds too. In fact, it seems that aid makes private investment more attractive, and so helps to keep capital in the country. Aid, however, is not the only answer to the problems of the bottom billion. In recent years, it has probably been overemphasized, partly because it is the easiest thing for the Western world to do, and partly because it fits so comfortably into a moral universe organized around the principles of sin and expiation. That overemphasis, which comes from the left, has produced a predictable backlash from the right. Aid does have serious problems, and more especially, serious limitations. Alone, it will not be sufficient to turn the societies of the bottom billion around, but it is part of the solution rather than part of the problem. The challenge is to complement it with other actions. Chapter 8. Military Intervention. After Iraq, it is difficult to arouse much support for military intervention. For me, this chapter is the toughest in the book, because I want to persuade you that external military intervention has an important place in helping the societies of the bottom billion, and that these countries' own military forces are more often part of the problem than a substitute for external forces. What external forces can do? Until around 1990, international military intervention into failing states was just an extension of the Cold War. The Soviet Union armed the government of Angola via Cuba, and the United States armed the Angolan rebel group UNITA via South Africa. These interventions certainly did not help Angola. Only after the end of the Cold War did it become possible for military intervention to be motivated by different considerations. The 1990s began well for military intervention. The expulsion of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait was a triumph of the new internationalism. Kuwait was a pretty clear-cut case for international intervention, expelling an aggressor. But there are three other important roles for external military intervention: restoration of order, maintaining post-conflict peace, and preventing coups. The restoration of order. After Kuwait came another situation that I regard as a clear-cut case for intervention: the restoration of order in a collapsed state. Total collapses are rare, but they happen. In this case, it was Somalia. I say the case for this was clear-cut because it is surely irresponsible to leave a huge territory such as Somalia with no government. So did the United States, which sent in its forces under Operation Restore Hope. Perhaps the US military was overconfident after the huge success in Kuwait, or perhaps it got overruled by the politicians. In any case, the media-intensive military intervention, the invasion of Somalia by US forces, was actually delayed by 24 hours so that film crews could get ashore in Somalia ahead of the troops, surely invited hubris. Perhaps the scale of intervention was inadequate for the security problems it encountered, but given the media coverage, the 18 US fatalities that were repeatedly displayed on television doomed the intervention. Don't get me wrong, it is terrible when peacekeeping troops get killed, and it is magnificent of a nation to send its troops into a dangerous situation. But that is what modern armies are for, to supply the global public good of peace in territories that otherwise have the potential for nightmare. Sometimes soldiers will die in the line of duty, and those who do are heroes to be honored. But armies cannot function productively at zero risk. Anyway, what had perhaps been planned as a great media coup for the US presidency had by October 1993 become a media nightmare, and US forces were promptly pulled out. Of course, post-Iraq, the fact that the United States pulled out of Somalia as a result of a mere 18 deaths looks even more bizarre, but that is what happened. The consequences for Somalia were miserable. More than 12 years later, it still has no functioning national government. By 1995, around 300,000 people had died, and beyond that, there are no estimates of the deaths from continuing conflict and the failure of health systems. But the biggest killer consequent upon the withdrawal was not what happened in Somalia, but the lesson that was learned: never intervene. It took only months to prove how disastrously wrong this lesson was. Remember that 1994 was the year of Rwanda. We didn't want a second Somalia with another 18 American soldiers killed, so we got Rwanda, in which 500,000 people were butchered, entirely avoidably, because international intervention was inadequate. This chapter is written for people who cannot imagine that it is better for 500,000 Rwandans to have died than for 18 Americans to be sacrificed. But there is another factor to consider too. The consequences of civil war spill over to the rich world in the form of epidemics, terrorism, and drugs. Some citizens of the rich world are going to die as a result of chaos in the bottom billion. The choice is whether these deaths will be among civilians as victims of the spillovers, or among soldiers who have volunteered to put things right. And there have been spillovers from Somalia. As a result of the continuing chaos, there has been an exodus of young Somali men to developed countries. In July 2005, one of them, an asylum seeker in Britain, filled his rucksack with explosives and tried to blow up commuters on the London Underground. In November 2005, a Somali gang murdered a policewoman in a bank robbery in Bradford, United Kingdom. I have a young son, and when he is older, I don't want him to be exposed to the risks of being a peacekeeping soldier. But I don't want him exposed to the risk of being blown apart in London or shot in Bradford by some exile from a failing state either. Nor do I want him exposed to the risk of disease. Somalia was the last place on earth to be home to smallpox. It was eliminated there by international health interventions a few years before the Somali state collapsed. Now such elimination would not be possible. Had the Somali state not lasted as long as it did, we would still have smallpox. On balance, I think that my child, and everyone else's, will be safer if we respond to the problem of failing states by restoring order, rather than by relying only on the myriad of defensive measures that we need if we don't. Maintaining post-conflict peace. After Rwanda, military intervention was back in business, and the new role was the maintenance of peace after conflict ended. It was pretty hit and miss. Some places got lots of troops, others not many. About the highest ratio in the world of foreign peacekeepers to population was in East Timor. One peacekeeper I met there was from Gambia, one of the smallest and poorest countries in Africa. When I asked him about the situation in East Timor, he told me that it was terrible. "These people are really poor," he said. If he thought so, they were. Later, when I met up with a diplomatic set, I asked why there were so many peacekeepers in that country. The answer I got about summed up the problems of foreign military intervention: because it was safe there. Governments that send soldiers to serve as UN peacekeepers are paid $1,000 per individual per month. For some countries, this is not a bad way of getting some income from their armies. The imperative is then that soldiers should not get themselves killed, so safe environments such as East Timor are ideal, and risky environments such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo are unattractive. Even if troops are sent to dangerous places, they often play it safe.